political analysts Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling, philosophy professor Al Jeaney, and live music in Studio 435 with the Chicago band Molehill. And now, here's your host, a man who just discovered Harry Potter, Justin Kaufman.
It's sort of true. This weekend was a Harry Potter whirlwind in my household. They had, I forgot what channel it was, but they had a marathon going. The middle Harry Potter movies? Not so good. That's what the rain will do for you. Get you in a Harry Potter frame of mind. The whole fam, you know, gets on the couch and watches 6 hours, 9 hours of Harry Potter. I don't know how I missed, I mean, I know the Harry Potter movies and the books, but I don't know how I missed all of those movies. I mean, I was a kid, I was a man of my 20s and 30s. And I just missed the Prisoner of Azkaban, the Goblet of Fire.
Yep.
And I watch him and I'm like, what is happening in these? Oh, God. Just get to like, it's like any movie that's like just taking its time to get to the actual meat. And all those movies in the middle, taking their time.
Yeah, I'm not a Harry Potter person either. And I feel guilty when there's such a big pop culture thing that I don't know anything about. I mean, right. I just didn't, like, I tried to watch, like, the first movie, and I was like, boring.
Right.
I'm just not into sci-fi fantasy. But then, yeah, there's a part of me that's like, I don't know any of these references when somebody mentions Harry Potter.
Well, I have a 9-year-old, so he's starting to get into it. Mm-hmm. And then it was just like me. Then it became more of like, well, how do I get the first ones on Netflix? Do I go to Hulu? Do they have it over on? Like, it's just trying to organize without paying any money to watch 7 Harry Potter movies. But we got to about 2 or 3.
He could read the books and then just act them out.
Yeah. And the joke, and it always is, every parent out there who's listening right now knows exactly what I'm going to say. By the end of the second, he wasn't even watching.
Oh.
I'm the only one still watching. And I'm like, why is it? I understand why the rat's talking. Can someone help me here? I'm going to look it up on my phone. Why did that rat turn into a guy? Anyway. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Welcome to the show. We're with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Very excited to be back here on 720 WGN, a rainy weekend, and of course rainy today as well. Going to be a little bit more rain this week. But we've got a great lineup of shows for the week to take you Monday through Friday, 7 to 11 here on 720 WGN. Tonight, Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy will be here. They got a lot to talk about. The budget, healthcare. President Trump on Sunday talk shows? Wow. What is it? I mean, there'd be a certain point where you just say, stop doing that. You know? I mean, I think he'd probably, but I mean, he loves it. He loves it, and we seem to love it too, because it's all over the next day. We'll talk with Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, Touche! Monday nights here. That's coming up after the 7:30 news. Coming up 8 o'clock, Al Jeaney's going to be back. Al's putting together a nice little package run here of Al Jeaney segments. You know, we talked about the 7 deadly sins. We've talked about love. We did on Valentine's Day. Tonight, we talk about work. It is International Workers Day, May 1st, May Day. A lot to do with Chicago. Has a lot to do with the history of organized labor, especially when it comes to the 8-hour workday and the fight against the right to strike, things of that nature. So we'll talk with Al Jeaney, who has really, he's done a whole book on work and the idea of what it means to work and what it means to essentially be a part of the labor force. But not only that, but to talk about the balance between what it means to be a good worker. You know, it's really what this is not about. It's not about corporate interests or about workers demanding certain, you know, time that they can be away from work. It's about what makes you a balanced human being. And Al Jeaney is going to be here. We'll talk a little bit philosophy. Our resident philosopher will be on the show coming up 8 o'clock. Also, Adam Hoge's going to join us, walk us off that ledge. I'm very positive about the Bears draft. I think it's a good move. I think if you need to get a franchise quarterback, go get him. A 4th-round pick. Who are we, Chicago? We gave up a 4th-round pick? Name the 4th-round picks. You know, besides Jordan Howard, who's the running back, who was a steal in the 5th round, most of any guys from 3rd to 7th round have not aren't even part of the roster anymore. So let's act like a real NFL team and start bringing in franchise players to be a part of this organization. So we'll talk with Adam Hoge about that. And also tonight, the Midwestern Film Festival is having their animation night. We'll talk with Mike McNamara and an animator here in town. And the band, the Studio 435, Molehill. Have some fun with them. Some cool synth. A lot of synth going on in that one. Love it. All right, it's Monday night. I'm excited. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. And this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. Come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, let's do the carryout, shall we? Here are today's top stories. All right, we're back at it for a big week ahead in Washington. Will Congress have the votes to repeal Obamacare? Will President Trump deal with North Korea? Will it be revealed that Ryan Seacrest is a cyborg? Seriously, somebody throw water on that dude. See if he glitches. President Trump started the week with a round of talk shows where he either did his best impression of Drunk History or his best impression of R. Kelly walking off the set of HuffPo Live. Remember that? Trump seems to be more agitated than usual with the media, which is following up on his Obama wiretap claims. Trump says that it was his opinion, and he doesn't have to stand by anything he says. And then he went on to say that President Andrew Jackson would have stopped the Civil War and that he would have been, quote-unquote, honored to sit down with North Korean President Kim Jong-un. So nothing to see here, folks. Just move along. Tuesday will be here before you know it. Also in D.C., it was inevitable, and I'm happy somebody's finally doing something about this. President Trump has finally taken aim at former First Lady Michelle Obama's initiatives to promote nutrition and education opportunities for girls in third world countries. USA! USA! We got rid of that stuff. Finally. I was wondering if he's ever going to get around to doing it, right? Whew! I mean, if he didn't undo nutrition, I mean, why even run for president, right? I will say this, though. Doesn't every First Lady's initiative end when they leave office? Right? Is this just maybe something Trump is right about with this sort of fake stream media? I don't remember the scathing CNN stories about the Obama administration ending the Reading First initiatives of Laura Bush, right? Just saying. The first quarter numbers are in for the economy, and it stalled. Shoot. Growth was worst in 3 years. This, of course, not the news you want if you're celebrating your first 100 days of a presidency that's based on being good at this stuff. I'd hate to be the guy who interrupted the cake and ice cream party with that news. Oh, excuse me, President. They just put out the numbers. Mm-mm. But let's face it. You know what? It's Obama's fault. It's always going to be, at least till 2020. But hey, a weak first quarter might help the president push forward tax reform or, as announced today, the thing about breaking up the big banks. When hearing this news, the big banks took a break from their money baths to text their lobbyists. Alfred, no! Speaking of former President Barack Obama, he's getting criticized for accepting that $400,000 payment to make a speech on Wall Street. When reached for comment at his Vermont home, Senator Bernie Sanders was like, "Hello? Hello? Who's this? Who's calling me?" Hey, how else will President Obama make $1 trillion off being president, right? That's how it works. It's only a matter of time till Obama's wearing a headscarf and speaking to Saudi oil barons and how great Saudi tourism is for $1 million. After that, look for him to put his name on the go-kart chain and petting zoos. Come on down to Obama's Racerama and stay and pet Obama's llamas. Even though we have over 1,000 shootings and 200 deaths, April was a down month for violence in Chicago. This stat alone tells me we got a long way to go. We should be celebrating a 13% drop in gun violence for the first 4 months of the year, right? Right. But this is a big problem. Last year was a statistical anomaly of sorts. Think about it. There was a spike in violence. But if we go back to just the average, it's still crazy high, right? Just not as high as 2016. So, yay? I mean, should the mayor hang a banner from the Willis Tower that says mission accomplished? I don't understand. In weather, man, it got real biblical this weekend, didn't it? 3 inches of rain, 12 inches downstate. Skilling said this weekend's totals matched April's monthly total. There may be more coming up this week, too. At this rate, even the earthworms can be looking for shelter. I saw the biggest one. I looked out into my front area, and I was like, oh, look at all that water. And there was just this huge worm, like snake-like. I was like, all right, stop with the rain. In sports, the Bears took a shocking, approach to the draft. moving up to snag North Carolina QB Mitchell Trubisky. There are many stories of agitated fans and pundits saying, what a head scratcher. Really, though, you only win in the NFL with a good quarterback. The Bears, well, they don't have one. And if you said, what about Mike Glennon? Stop yourself right there. Tape yourself on a recorder. Play it back. It sounds dumb, doesn't it? Really does. Glennon's a great guy to pay the going rate to be quarterback for the Chicago Bears in 2017. And if he does well and the Bears are a playoff team, we keep him going, right? This is all about the future, and the Bears now don't have to worry about that position for a couple years. No more Brian Hoyer. Now, will the slew of defensive players from last year's please step up? Maybe. Although the trip story about the Bears asking Mike Glennon to show up at a draft party at Soldier Field with Bears fans seems totally ridiculous. Did you see this? The Bears brass had to know that was going to be weird. I mean, really, they sent Mike Glennon to deal with fans and to be there when they chose his replacement. That's like going to prom and then getting there, and then your date gets down on one knee and asks somebody else to marry him, right? Then you just quietly walk over to the solo table. Solo table's always fun. Always love the solo table. Hey. Yeah, I'm Mike Glennon. Nice to meet you. Hey, I'm Justin. Anyway, Chicago's mad, but I wonder how much of it's just, you know, what we know, right? We're comfortable in hating on the Bears and their boneheaded decisions. It's as Chicago as Solozy Edelson. It's just what it is. In basketball, Jimmy Butler and D-Wade said they're going to help management recruit free agents to Chicago. Really? Chris Paul and Steph Curry are free agents, right? Money? Here's mouth. Make it happen, Hollywood. The Cubs and Sox are done with April, and both teams flying high. Can you believe it? The White Sox have a better record than the Cubs on May 1st. Cubs are holding down first place in the NL Central by a game. The Sox a half game behind the Indians. The Cubs game tonight delayed, taking on the Phillies. The Sox just got underway in Kansas City. Also, Adam Eaton, former White Sox center fielder, out for the rest of the season with a torn ACL. Oof. Yikes. And finally tonight, an avocado shortage is threatening guacamole production for the upcoming Cinco de Mayo. What? No avocados? You can't celebrate a key Mexican military victory without avocados. Can't we push Cinco de Mayo back to June? All in favor? All right. The ayes have it. That's the carryout for April 28, 2017. Actually, it's May 1st, right? I don't know why it says that. That's the carryout for May 1st, 2017. Hey, due to the avocado shortage, we're substituting avocados in our nachos. I hope you like pears. I gotta start writing all my checks with May 1st now, huh? All right, coming up, Touche, Chris Rowling, Dave Lundy in studio tonight. We got a lot to talk about, from the budget to healthcare to North Korea and everything in between. It's a download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing well, my friend. How are you?
Did you have a good weekend?
I did.
Did your family do the Harry Potter? Well, that's a nice little...
You like that?
What is that?
So I heard you talking about the Harry Potter bonanza, the smorgasbord of Harry Potter. We did the... You know what? It's so funny because I'm laughing. I'm sitting up here listening to you, and I'm laughing because we did the exact same thing.
Yeah, right. There's so much Harry Potter was on this weekend. It was crazy.
Well, we've got it on disc, too, and, you know, my wife's been jonesing to see it again. She's a total Harry Potter geek, and the kids are like, oh, can we watch, can we watch, can we watch? So, of course, we loaded in number one, and then, of course, one led into number two, and then, you know, the next thing you know, I've got, you know, Harry Potter out of my ears. And
yeah, the next thing you know, you're the only one watching. That's what happened. It's like everyone left the room, and I'm like, I think he's a werewolf. Guys, anybody? Am I the only one watching?
And then I forgot in the first one, that's the Sorcerer's Stone, right? Is that the first one?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That the guy at the end there, he was wrapped in the dude's head. The thing there, the head scarf.
Paintings
whatever.
Talk. There's so much going on.
Staircases move. It's like my house.
It is. It's a lot like a house.
Yeah, it was funny.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
All right. It's Touche here in Monday night here, 720 WG on the download. In studio tonight, Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling, as they are every Monday night, to discuss national politics. Touche.
Touche.
Discuss is a nice word. That's the gentle word.
Discuss.
Discuss.
Yeah, we do discuss.
We always discuss.
You're quietly, low-key.
Where do you want to start?
Why don't we start with the budget.
Let's start with the budget.
Let's talk about budget.
I can't remember who it was. I think it might have been the Washington Post today said both the Democrats and the White House are claiming victory on the budget. Chris.
Totally wrong. Fake news. The White House did not win really almost anything here. This was Paul Ryan fumbling. You know, you hand the guy the ball on the 7-yard line. You say, okay, the end zone is right here. And he finds a way not to fund the wall, not to fund the sanctuary cities.
Sounds like a Bears running back.
Quiet. He's funding Planned Parenthood. He's funding NEA. He's funding NEH. You know, why do we even elect these people? Why do you even have majorities on both sides of the Capitol Dome if you can't get anything done?
What would the White House...
David?
What would the White House... claim victory on was the idea that they
on the military.
Oh, because they got rid of the sequester.
Yeah,
Democrats were opposing getting rid of the sequester. Really?
Well, the Democrats under Obama had never gone along, but now, I mean, look, I'm not saying that that's a big victory. I said that basically Ryan capitulated, but what he's putting out is I've increased funding for our soldiers. God bless him. And, you know, we're happy to see that. But that's so much less than what we hoped. We on the Republican side. David's probably licking his chops.
David, is it a win for Democrats when it comes
to
this?
You know, Justin, I'm licking my chops.
excuse David while he licks his chops.
No, I Donald Trump is a horrible negotiator. I don't know how this guy survived in the real estate business because he got nothing. He proposed a budget that was draconian in the extreme. I'm going to cut the EPA by a third. I'm going to cut the National Institute of Health because, of course, we don't need health in this country. I'm going to build that wall. Remember, build that wall? We're going to build that wall. Well, there's nothing in here for the wall. The National Institutes of Health got a $2 billion bump. EPA was not cut in any material sense. I mean, on priority after priority after priority, they didn't defund any cities that do sanctuary cities. I mean, literally nothing he said he was going to do got done in this budget. And so this was a stopgap budget, but it begs the question of how they think they're going to do any better come the next full fiscal year.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, as it is a stopgap, we'll revisit this again. Why does he not get these things? You say it's Speaker Ryan. Why is he not getting the things when he puts it out and everybody seems to know that's the direction he wants to go?
I don't think Ryan honestly, I don't think, despite the fact that he's been in there for a while, I don't think Ryan has his footing. And I don't think that there is a real sense between the White House and Ryan of what the agenda is. I think that the very clear contract with the American voters that Trump enunciated during the campaign, laid out a legislative program. Now, you know, it makes people like David go crazy, but I mean, let's just stick with the facts here for a second. Trump said, here's what I'm about. This is my first 100 days. That never, as I said before, that was when he and Ryan were having a spat. Mm-hmm. They weren't talking to each other. Ryan was disinviting him, et cetera, et cetera. So that didn't really mesh. Okay. The gears didn't really mesh on that. And I think we're still seeing it. And it is frustrating as all get out to folks like me. And I think more and more Republicans are saying, what the heck is going on down there? It looks like Charles Schumer has a veto over Republican legislative.
I don't agree. I think that it's the Republicans who have a veto over Republican legislation. What is fascinating here. Thank you. What is fascinating, we should name our segment that. What is fascinating here is that you look, you know, under Obama, in the first 2 years of Obama, when they had the House and the Senate and the White House, Republicans kept saying, oh, you know, Democrats could do anything. Democrats could do anything. Democrats would say, well, whoa, whoa. We don't have a real veto-proof majority. We don't have a working veto-proof majority. Republicans would say, oh, you whiners. You could do anything you want. Well, guess what? Welcome to the Constitution. It doesn't quite work that way when you have people within your own party who don't agree. And we're going to talk about health care in a minute. But, you know, on the health care thing in particular, you've got moderate Republicans saying, no way. I'm not signing on to this horrific health care program. It doesn't accomplish what we promised, and it just hurts people.
Well, we'll get to health care. I am interested in the media interviews that President Trump had over the weekend, one of which he said the Democrats are just an obstructionist party. They get in the way of everything. They are the most obstruction. They're in the way. They are standing in the way of anything. I mean, does he recognize the fact that that's sort of like the minority party always gets that obstructionist label? Or is there something to be said about that, Chris, that the Democrats are just not really looking to move the country forward?
I don't think there – something like 28 bills were passed and sent down to the White House and presented and signed in the first 100 days. And people don't talk about because they're not earth-shaking legislation. So there's stuff that has actually gone through Congress. I made the point over the weekend with some friends that I think Democrats were obstructing appointments, like in the case of the cabinet. In almost every cabinet member's case, Democrats used parliamentary maneuvering to extend the period, and that is certainly their right. And it's unfortunate, and that's where things are these days. And I also will say that Trump is way too slow in appointing people. We don't even have an Office of Personnel Management director nominated. And here we have to defund the left by cutting off the public employee unions. And every day is going by here and we're not making any progress.
Yeah, the good news is that because the Democrats use the obstructionist tactics to slow down the cabinet nominations, Republicans had that extra time to be able to prepare appointments that they immediately unleashed. Oh, wait, no, that's the parallel universe. Trump doesn't know how to govern. His party doesn't know how to govern. They, you know, day one or day 50 or whatever it was, they fired all the U.S. attorneys in a big show. Okay, we're going to fire all the U.S. attorneys. And you would think if you were going to fire the U.S. attorneys, you might have one to replace. They have nominated of the, I forget how many U.S. attorneys in this country. They've nominated a grand total of zero U.S. attorneys. I mean, these guys haven't nominated the most basic positions within our government.
Actually, here in Chicago, I ran into one of the highest ranking political people in the U.S. attorney's office. I said, well, Mr. X, what do you hear? He said, nothing. Nothing.
Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, my guest tonight, of course. It's Touche Monday nights here on The Download. We'll take a quick break, and we got to come back and talk healthcare. The thought is that there could be a vote to repeal Obamacare this week. We will talk about what's in this version and whether or not there's political capital to get it through. A lot of things coming out of the White House that are different than what's happening in Congress, I think speaks to the same question we were just talking about and getting on the same page with the Congress and the White House. All right, so we'll continue the conversation here on The Download. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
It's The Download. 720 WGN. Touche. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy in studio tonight, as they are every Monday night. Healthcare. Has President Trump learned from the first failure on repealing Obamacare? Will we see something new this time around?
No, he has not. Chris is going to give me grief because he apparently thinks
you
that...
You ignorant slut!
Thank you, Jane. I was waiting. I've been waiting, by the way, for like a year and a half, 2 years.
I've never said that.
For somebody to actually say that.
I'm
glad it was you who said the words
ignorant slut. And I don't think you're a
slut.
Jan, I want you to know
you.
Your husband's not a slut.
Thank you. So, thank you.
Moving on.
When
is the LGBTQ segment?
Trump has not learned anything from the first failure, as is evidenced by the fact that he keeps promising things that are not actually in the bill. So today and over the weekend, he kept saying, absolutely, pre-existing conditions must be in that bill, and I'm going to support that. And they're in that bill with a couple of minor problems. One, you get a waiver. States can get a waiver for the pre-existing condition. And two, and probably most importantly, under the current Obamacare, you cannot charge somebody more if they have a pre-existing condition.
And it seemed that Trump...
He got that from Barack Obama. If you want your plan, you can keep your plan. If you like your doctor... Obama kept saying things that were not in the bill that never got into the plan. And look where Obama ended up. David worships at the Obama altar every morning. I mean, my God, he's more devoted than most Catholics I know. It's unbelievable. And now he's attacking Trump for doing the same thing Obama did, lying about the darn program.
Thank you for admitting that Trump is lying about the health care bill.
He's not lying. It's just that you don't understand what's in the program. And I want to tell you, here's the big difference between then and now. This is not legislating. And that's the thing that they have to learn.
What does that mean?
here's what that means. Nothing that passes in the House of Representatives is necessarily going to get into the U.S. code, because you have to go through something called the Senate. And after you go through the Senate, then you go through another institution, which is known as the Conference Committee. In the Conference Committee,
I'm just a bill. Together,
yeah. You yeah, legislate. I'm only a they bill. Legislate. In, I have had weekends of my life spent in conference committees in the House and in the Senate. And that's where they actually write the bill.
So it doesn't actually matter what they pass in legislation?
What is being said now is about what can get a majority now in the House, what will be said in the Senate, what gets a majority in the Senate, and what is said in the conference committee is what can get a majority on both sides.
Can I just say, are you worried that moderate Republicans are backing off the plan? Are you worried that, I forgot the senator or the congressman who said, I'm out.
Repeal and replace is doctrine, and it will be fulfilled.
Repeal and replace is doctrine, and it won't be fulfilled because they already have 22 no votes, and they can only afford 22 no votes. Look, I have to tell you, as a Democrat, I hope, I pray this Congress passes this piece of garbage legislation, because if they do, we will take the House. As Michael Steele just said on MSNBC, the former party chair, the politics of this suck for the Republicans.
I'm telling you, if they don't, David, I think, is whistling past the graveyard. He wants desperately to take the House. I know that. But the fact is that if they don't repeal and replace, they will lose. If they repeal and replace and we get some job creation. And look, the big story last week politically was in the first quarter, we had paltry, unacceptable low levels of growth. And that's it happened on Trump's watch. So I'm going to assign that to Trump just to try and be consistent between allocating blame to Obama and to Trump. Trump cannot have that. And I believe, and I said last week, that's why they announced the tax thing so hurriedly, because they knew on the inside what the numbers were going to come up
and
with.
As I just said, I mean, it also makes it feel like they can push it because they're like, we need to get some growth going. So
exactly.
It's actually politically time.
And a lot of people like me, these are the same people complaining about Paul Ryan. Where is the tax program? Why is the tax program not on the table? What is going on with the tax program?
Can we talk about the tax program, Chris?
Let's talk about North Korea.
Because that tax program that Trump proposed is out. First of all, it wasn't a program. It was a one pager. But that one pager is awesome for me. I have my own business, so that means I get to lower my tax rate from the 30%+ range to 15%. Rock on. I get to eliminate the alternative minimum tax. That's going to save me several thousand bucks a year. I got to tell you, that Trump tax plan is awesome for Dave Lundy and his family. Unfortunately, it's not awesome, I guess I should say, for my children, who are going to be saddled with the extra debt from this
like
outrageous.
You care. Like
well,
you care.
Trump has said he doesn't care about the deficit anymore.
He said that in the campaign. Why are you just waking up now? What is the problem? You need a clock radio.
Democrats balance budgets. Republican break budgets.
Come on. Republicans have been in love with tax cuts since John Fitzgerald Kennedy taught us in 1959, 60, 61, 62. And so we learned, and Reagan applied. And guys like David will say to the fare thee well that revenues went down. They didn't go down. Revenues went up in the Reagan era because of the tax cuts. And David, what
just
did
not
you say
as much as spending.
At noon on Friday, what announcement did you make? I know it's off the record, but I'm going to put you on the record right now. What did you say at the Lundy lunch about aileron communication? You are
hiring.
Okay. That is the Trump plan. You cut taxes and people start hiring. You are an example.
Because I have a millennial that quit too early. It's the Trump plan. Oh, my God.
You are becoming the Trump example.
There you go. Now I get some energy going.
Can we get to North Korea?
Yes, we are hiring. Aileron is hiring. If anybody is interested, let me know.
Two minutes on North Korea. Because we've talked North Korea the last 3 weeks. What do you want to add to the story?
I want to say on Friday you saw real leadership from Rex Tillerson and the United States of America at the Security Council, where they were putting together a real case using the institution in its best possible way. And that was undercut today when, off the cuff, President Trump says, sure, I'd be honored to meet with Kim Jong-un.
Use the word honored.
What the heck does that mean? Unless that's been coordinated with the Chinese. We won't know for maybe months or years, who knows. But that was a truly odd thing that he said.
Yeah, but it's not coordinated with the Chinese any more than inviting Duterte from the Philippines, who is a literally a murdering thug who has murdered thousands and thousands and thousands of his people who are accused of having something to do with the drug trade without trial. No, this is a fact, Chris. This president is sucking up to the most vile, murderous dictators on this planet.
That was Obama. Obama sucked up to the mullahs. Obama sucked up to Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, and to Maduro. Obama sucked up to Cuba. Obama did nothing for the Cuban people. He stood with the Castros against the Cubans. You talk about thousands and thousands of people murdered.
Chris, I think you're smoking that legal weed because you are insane.
Not only do I not take false drugs, I don't even smoke.
How did Obama suck up to Hugo Chavez? You guys just
It was the first three years of his administration. He did everything. You go back and read Mary Anastasia O'Grady in the Wall Street Journal, and you're going to get educated. You're going to find out something about it. You know, it's really, I'm looking forward to it.
I love how when I live through periods and read the news and I'm a voracious consumer of news, Chris likes to say, oh, no, that never happened. What you just said never really happened.
I want
to
tell you.
You're good at that.
Barack Obama supported Hugo Chavez diplomatically and economically, and that spread upon the public record. Obama was supporting the mullahs. Obama did not confront Assad.
Ding, 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 ding. The bell has rung. Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy, another rousing edition of Touche here on the Download, 720 WGN. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling. Till next Monday.
I hear you got a great segment coming up.
Yeah, it's good. Thanks, Rob. It's a Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little bit later in the show, we'll talk about James Beard Awards tonight. The Oscars of Food are going on here in Chicago at the Lyric Opera. We will talk about the winners and losers coming up. Also, the Midwest Independent Film Festival is having their first animation night tomorrow night at the Landmark up in Lincoln Park, or Lakeview. So we will talk with Mike McNamara and some select filmmakers who will be in studio tonight to talk about animation in the Midwest. And the band Molehill. Synth sounds of Molehill in studio tonight, Studio 435 live in studio. Well, today, May 1st, a holiday, if you will, for the entire world, not just here in America. International Workers' Day, also known as May Day, celebrates not just work. Now, it's not like a Labor Day. It's the right to work.
Right.
It's essentially a real celebration of some of the things that have happened in terms of workers and the plight of workers, organized labor.
The rights of workers and the right to work and the importance of work in the role of civilization and living in community with others.
And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Our resident philosopher, Al Jeany, in studio. He is a professor at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. He's also the author of My Job, Myself, Work and the Creation of the Modern Individual. And we thought we would talk about that tonight. Professor, good to see you. Thanks for being
here. Wonderful to be here. Always good. After that wonderful, spirited political conversation, I feel like cleaning up afterwards.
All right, so let's talk about this, because it is different. This holiday is different than the American Labor Day, which is really almost a celebration. You have to work, therefore we...
It is a self-celebration that America, that we really made ourselves. In a very real sense, America is a nation of immigrants and entrepreneurs. We came here, we created a nation, we created a way of life. We're the richest country in the world. We're still an 800-pound gorilla that everybody wants to be like for all of our problems. But this is our self-celebration. Hey, aren't we wonderful? And I've made this with my own hands. It's like my father saying to us, we had to be there at a Sunday meal. And because that was the only meal he shared with us, because he worked late. He wanted to be able to say, and my grandfather, I paid for this. I worked for this. And let us celebrate together. Tutti mangiare lo same. We all eat together. But I think May 1st is Workers' Day. It is the right of work. It's what Pope John Paul was talking about, Laborum Exercens, where we were talking about Rerum Novarum with Leo X, that people have a right to work as individuals. That is a God-given right and a natural requirement in order to have a better life. And so people need work, and they need work that offers dignity and a living wage. And then something called the United Nations comes along and writes to the United Nations Rights of Man. And in that as well is the right to work and the right to a fair wage. And there's something else, too, that's implied but not always specified, the right not to work, the right to have time off to enjoy the work.
Well, that plays out here in Chicago, of course, the eight-hour workday sort of conceived after
Within Haymarket miles and everything. Of where we're sitting right now.
You know, it's such an interesting part because it's even joking around. I mean, Roe was joking around with me, just sort of like, oh, the communist holiday.
Right.
Like this idea of, but it's much more, it goes much deeper than
well,
sort of
this.
Well,
it is a communist holiday. What they did is they took the European notion and the basic notion of federation, the Catholic notion of the right to work. I mean, you could have any problem you want with the Catholic Church, but you can't complain about the Catholic Church in regard to its teachings, in regard to the rights of human beings and the right to work. And what the Russians did was made the worker, and of course, the worker is soldier too, you know.
Right.
So they made the soldier and the labor of workers to make this incredible army and march these missiles and tanks down the street. But it's at its core really the celebration of individual and collective work and the rights of human beings for work.
You know, it's one of these holidays as well, as we've seen this more and more in recent memory and more of contemporary society, where you're seeing other issues that are that are human being issues, whether it be immigration, women's issues, sort of tied together. You see the march tonight that went downtown to, from Daley Plaza all through the loop. There's so many different factions. Where does that come from? Where's the idea that all these sort of social issues are tied together?
Well, I think the social issues are the latest guys down the block, if you will. I mean, social issues come, you know, it's the famous notion of Bertolt Brecht, grub first, you know, leisure later. So you got to take care of food first. And I think that we didn't worry about that. Remember, the 8-hour work thing came at the in the middle of the Industrial Revolution, some sense here, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours to do what we will. Well, it's only really existed in the society in a very short period of time.
Yeah, right.
And certainly World War II changed that, the Depression changed that, everything has changed that, and now we put in too many hours at work, and so you get millennials saying, I want to work, but whoa, let's slow this down.
We're going to get to that.
They get to that, right. But the reality is, once we established, once we established this rich country, we began to say, okay, it can't just be work. What else is there besides work? I don't want to just be defined by the fact that I'm a worker and work does define us. What else is there? And now we're talking about, I think with, she was just in town this week, Sheryl Sandberg, talking about, you know, I was a little bit wrong in Lean In. Maybe we also have to lean out. Maybe we have to talk about how do we blend work with real life. And
it's a great philosophical question, Al, and that's what we're going to talk about. We'll take a break here. But, the question is, as we sort of celebrate the idea of the right to work, and you said also the right to not work, because there is a work-life balance, and you're seeing more and more like a push with the sort of high-tech, the world that we live in now, that work it somehow is us. Like, it is everything.
It always has
been,
but now we're much more aware of it.
But and maybe at a certain point we need to go backwards to say some of the things that we learned in the turn of the century, in the 19th century, give you a little bit of idea that possibly we want to get back to the idea of a work-life balance.
Yes.
All right, Al Genie in studio. He is a resident philosopher here on The Download. He's also a professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University Chicago. He's also the author of My Job, Myself, Work, and the Creation of the Modern Individual. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we'll continue our conversation about work on this May Day. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, our resident philosopher, Al Genie. He's a professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. Joins us from time to time here on the download to talk about big societal issues.
Big issues.
We don't do the little stuff.
No.
We leave the little stuff to a different hour.
Another hour.
He's also the author of My Job, Myself, Work, and the Creation of the Modern Individual. We're talking, of course, today about May Day, International Workers' Day. We saw some rallies today in Union Park and also a march downtown. You know, but really it's about the right to work and, as you said, the right to not work. I have a question just about a history lesson. I know that you've covered this in the book and other places. But, you know, when you think about the Haymarket riot and the movement here in Chicago, the modern labor movement, to essentially get 8 hours on, 8 hours off, 8 hours in the week or weekends
for,
off.
For what you will.
For what you will.
You will.
So the question I have is that something that that we had to change as human beings, meaning you go all the way back in the centuries and we understood work-life balance and then we lost sight of it and then we get to the turn of the 20th century and you're like, oh, we got to remember to do this, or is that brand new?
Right. No, I think we have to look at the human condition as a project in development. Just so we're talking about, you know, new electronics, what we have in our pockets right now are not phones, they're computers with a phone app.
Right.
It's a portable computer. You could do anything with that wonderful thing. And when we think about this, the lifespan of the human beings and the lifespan of civilization – Work is developed according to the technology of the times. So in agrarian societies, and when there was a lush society, like in the growing season in Egypt and the growing season in Middle Europe, the Italians and the Romans talked about this, you didn't work constantly because you were committed to a certain life cycle.
To a harvest or whatever. Harvest time.
So there was rush, push, then you were forced to be inside, so on and so forth. And in fact, the Romans had over 280 holidays. If that's possible in a 500-day period, I just don't understand that. They, you know, was that a whole day off, et cetera, et cetera? And so I think that when you're talking about agrarian society, I think what we understand about work really starts to rev up with the Industrial Revolution and the abuses of the Industrial Revolution.
So essentially when the technology catches up and you're like, we can make stuff faster, make these workers work
Marx
harder.
Marx isn't a communist. Marx is a critic of the work situation. Marx is a critic of the abuse of labor, of the abuse of workers. And he's talking about the right of the worker to have a life larger than work and not to be owned by the organization that he works for, that he or she works for. And it was both men and women. Now, listen, we're sitting in Chicago. Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle. You had to read it in high school, and I had to read it in college, and I assigned it to students. It's still the Bible of one generation after another, one group of immigrants after another comes to the south side of Chicago, starts to work in the slaughterhouses, and is used up by the slaughterhouses until they themselves are slaughtered either physically or psychologically and can't work anymore. And they were talking, if you remember the opening scene, they're planning a wedding or the opening part of the book. Well, it's a Saturday night, but they're working to 5 o'clock and they're rushing to get clean to go to the wedding, and they got to work the next day. You know,
and you hear the story. I mean, obviously with the Pullman porters,
right,
and this, the other stories of factory workers at the turn of the century.
Absolutely.
You know, I guess the question I have is when I think about advocating for a work-life balance,
right,
and that's really what the movement was predicated here in Chicago.
Right.
Was that to sort of stem the tide of abuses in the workplace,
or
is it more about, hey, listen, I think I should have more fairness. I should be 8, 8, and 8.
No. I think it's to stem the tide of abuses and to say enough already. Basta, I want to stop this right now. And that only can happen in a kind of a post-subsistence a society that's not just based on one industry, not just agrarian. And so people began to say, and you think about that. Adam Smith said the only purpose of production is consumption. Well, if all they're doing is working, they didn't have time to consume. They didn't have the money to consume. Remember, Henry Ford did two major things in regards to the industry. 5-day work week and $5 day, because his workers couldn't afford the products that they were making. And so I think that what we're talking about here is the notion of more life than simply work,
right,
is a mid-19th century phenomena that grows up in Europe, in many different places, and then here in America and the union movement.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting too, as technology continues to progress, and like you just said about the phones and small computers and the way that we view work, and even Sheryl Sandberg talking about leaning in, there almost seems to be a return to the idea of this identification or this identity of where you work or who you are and what you do.
Yeah.
You know, almost more than maybe we were moving away from that, but at a certain point you're seeing more of this sort of like, I'm attached to my work. I have to work because I got to keep up. I got to check my email at 2 o'clock in the morning.
I have to tell you, I think we've always been branded by our work. Tu sai quello che fai, tu sai quello che mangi. You are what you eat, you are what you do in some sense. And so people got identity from work. May have been a bad identity. I'm shoveling stuff in Alabama. I'm a garbage person. Hey, garbage person, you don't call it anymore. Call it sanitation engineer because they make a certain amount of money and et cetera,
good
et cetera,
money,
right? But I think we've always been labeled by that. But now we're reasserting that I've always been labeled by that, but I want more than that label. I need more than that. And that's where people are asserting. And by the way, there's enough distributive income. You know, when you talk about people who have more than one job, it's because they need that second job. Nobody wants to work 3 part-time jobs.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, 57% of those people are women who are taking care of families. But you do this. I think we were talking about this before with health insurance. Health insurance is a major issue in the workplace. You know, what are my benefits right now? And I think one of the benefits of work is I have to have the right not to always be working. I have to have the right to be making a living wage so that I could step away from work. And by the way, just so it's always clear, I think every benefit in the workplace comes out of the union movement, no matter how bad the unions are generated, no matter what happened to them, no matter the fact that less than
12%. The idea that there's anything standardized is because of that movement.
That people have time off, that you have the weekend. There's such a thing as a weekend that never really exists. existed. I mean, I traveled in countries where it's Saturday or Sunday. So how do you tell? Because you know, in Africa, you can't tell because it's just another day that people work and have to work. So I think in a post-subsistence economy, we begin to ask the questions, is there more to life than work?
Well, let me ask about that. 847 just texted, and I think she hits on an appropriate part about, you know, we see all the time with these unemployment numbers or employment numbers, they go up, they go down, and then you'll hear the politicians say, well, it's not accurate because a lot of people aren't looking for work anymore. What about people? I mean, not just the sort of the financial stress it takes to not have a job, but the mental or psychological part of not being identified by your workplace.
Oh, I think it's huge. Not only, you know, think about it. We get status, stuff, success, and identity from work. All those things, you know, tell me your zip code and I'll tell you your general, your financial bracket, right? Mm-hmm. Not your telephone number. You can get that. That could be any place, but tell me your zip code and I'll say something. I could make a pretty educated guess about, you know, how much you make or what you do, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we really do get
work
the same way. And I think we want more than that. To come back to your question, I think we need, the identity is there, but we want more than that. And it only happens when there's that pause when you say, I am making enough. Now what do I do? And that's the real question.
Well, I mean, do you have to start to rethink the way that we are, as you say, as we're a human race
that's continuing
to progress? Do you have to start thinking about ways that we can start to identify ourselves without work because the work field has changed and we're not necessarily employed anymore?
And this is something we're going to do, I think, in the next show. We're living longer. Now what do we do? You know, I can't tell you my age because my wife will be furious, but I'm in my mid-70s. And the reality is I still have a job and I have no plans to retire at the moment, et cetera, because I'm still enjoying the job. Well, like quit the job, you bet. But the reality is if we're going to live longer, I just mentioned to you off air, if you were born in 2000, what the geneticists are suggesting and the biologists are suggesting, you'll probably live to 100. Well, you can't retire at 65. You got enough money to make it to 100?
So it almost is going to make what we're just talking about, by trying to adjust the way we're identified, it's going to put more pressure on what you do because you have to do it longer.
But what we have to learn to do is we have to work at not working. That is, we're going to have to work at leisure. We're going to have to figure out who am I now that I no longer job? Who am I that I'm no longer a professor? Who am I that I no longer have a rostrum to speak from? Who am I now that I no longer write the novels? I'm reading a biography of Churchill right now, and he lived to 91. And what he missed the most after the stroke when he was 82, I believe, he lost some of his language skills. And Winston Churchill was brilliant.
He's an orator,
57 books, et cetera, and Nobel laureate in literature. He was brilliant, and he dictated that, and he lost those literary skills, and he knew it, and it pained him immensely because his words were his life.
Professor Al Genie in studio tonight. All right, we'll take a break. We'll get an update on Rob's news, and then we'll come back, and we'll talk a little bit about the different generations, you know, because there seems to be a difference in the way that work is viewed from baby boomers to millennials, as we know now, or as Steve Gadlin calls them, millenniums, here on the download. Al Genie, resident philosopher here on the download, professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University Chicago, also the author of My Job, Myself, Work and the Creation of the Modern Individual. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get Rob's news, and we'll continue the conversation here on May Day with Professor Al Genie. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's the download here on 720 WGN. Coming up a little bit later this hour, Adam Hoge is going to join us. WGN Radio's Bears reporter. Going to walk us off the ledge, give us some positive. He's got a great story today on WGNRadio.com. He did his 10 thoughts, really breaking down how it all, you know, there's this myth that the 49ers are geniuses, you know, for being able to get the Bears to move to 2. And Adam kind of pushes back a little bit that, you know, there's a lot of luck that's involved in this stuff. And one thing goes this way and one thing goes that way. And the 49ers go from heroes to goats. And, you know,
absolutely.
And that the Bears draft is not as bad as you think. So we will talk about that coming up.
I agree.
Professor Al Genie in studio with me. He is a resident philosopher here on the download, also the professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University Chicago, and the author of My Job, Myself, Work and the Creation of the Modern Individual. Al, of course, here for May Day, International Workers' Day. We're talking about the right to work. You know, and And a lot of what we were talking about in the first half, and we continue here, has to do with sort of meaningful work.
Right.
You know, it's not just sort of like clocking. Right. It's how the identity and surrounding. Talk about what does that mean? What is meaningful work?
Well, meaningful work always depends on a lot of things. If we say that work gives you status, stuff, and success, meaningful work depends on the individual as well. What are your talents? What can you do? You know, the problem is if work molds us and forms us, that if we have stupid, monotonous work, we become stupid and monotonous.
Right.
But I think meaningful work is, there's been some basic definitions. It's about the skill set that you have. I mean, the unhappiest people I've met in the workplace and doing these surveys over the years are people who get the job they've always wanted, but they can't do it. And Bull Durham is a perfect example of that, right? If I had hit the ball four more times, I could have stayed in the bigs, and you know, I would have been batting 250. But he couldn't make that ball four more times, and so to finally get the job that you really want, but you can't do it, is very frustrating. But I think when they're talking about it's about talent, ability, lack of repetitiveness, lack of stupidity, obviously, but that your skill set fits. And you find dignity in it. And of the surveys they've been doing for years and years and years on what they want, people want for meaningful work, here are the five, top five. The only one thing has moved in it. First one is interesting work. We want work that it's engaging and that's meaningful. And that could be anything. You know, what do you make? I make hula hoops. Well, that's not very interesting. Well, it is for me because that's my skill set, you know. And I always talk about this, and I say this very, very carefully. The Down syndrome individuals who work at Jules and Dominic's. I've had a cousin who worked there for 40 years, Dominic's. He was happiest. That was his skill set. He was in the right place at the right time, and that was wonderful. Appreciation and recognition for what you do.
Right.
Somebody says, huge good job. You know, you're really good job. Secondly, your boss and your fellow workers are supportive and worthwhile. Doesn't mean you don't disagree and all that, but there's a supportive workplace. Third, working conditions and proper tools. You know, just critical, you know, to be a teacher and not have chalk. Right. The chalkboard is gone, so on and so forth. And then solid salary. And I think solid salaries moved up to three or four, but those are the top five that people want. They want something that they are involved in, engaged in, they feel is meaningful. And that's why the happiest people that I found to really celebrate their work are people that involve others, doctors, lawyers, actors, comedians. We know that, even though kind of manic depressive, we both know that sometimes, that they really enjoy, they're only alive on stage. And so, but that's meaningful for them. I think the happiest people that feel that they have really meaningful work are people that feel that there are, others are benefit from
do
the
you
work.
See that at all adapting or evolving or adjusting when it comes to different generations? You know, are there like, is the idea that all of those things, the five things you just said for baby boomers, they have to be there. But for millennials, maybe they don't. Or vice versa, meaning do you see it almost getting out of focus and blurry and distorted? I think of millennials and there's always...
all of us of generations, including the silent generation, my father's generation, my mother's generation, they wanted to be happy in work, but they had to take any work they could find because it was depression. So, you know, why are you doing this job? You ask a lot of dads, well, why are you doing this? I found out you were painting on the side. Well, yeah, I wanted to be a painter, but then you came along and Mary came along and Billy came along and your mother wanted a house and I had to find a job. But I think the silent generation was happy of any work that you can get because work itself was dignity, even if they weren't happy at the work. I come home every day, I bring you the paycheck. Baby boomers, even though things were tough, remember this is after World War II, there weren't enough universities, everything was very competitive, we became goal-oriented, and we saw our parents as hard workers, we became hard workers as well. I thought as a baby boomer, we'd all be smoking dope in California eating organic food. We're not. You know, we're not. What happened to the age of Aquarius? We're bankers. And we're lawyers and we're college professors, et cetera, I think, but I don't really remember. But you know what I mean? I mean, that's really what we want to do. The baby boomers wound up being as diligent, but at a better level job than the silent generation. Right. Now, Generation X, our children, my children, unfortunately, your group of individuals, well, they saw us. They worked pretty hard, but they wanted to be a little more individualistic. They wanted to be a little more flexible. And they started to worry about a work-life balance. And you started to worry about your kids in a different way, you know. And I think that I think we gave you a little bit of that.
So, I mean, not unlike what the caller said, just this idea of, like, trying to find an identity outside of work.
Right, identity outside of itself. But the work became an important factor in driving you to take care of your children. So you wanted to be happy at work so you could be happy with them. You can't come home from 10 hours of drudgery and embarrassment and humiliation and say, let's forget about that. Let's play chess. make a gourmet meal and have Olympiadic sex. It's just not going to happen, you know. You're just going to be easy. Bring me the bourbon or bring me the Blatz. And, right. You know, I want to get.
I need a recliner.
Right. And by the way, it's called exhaustion. You know, you have to have something left. And then the millennials, the younger people, you know, and by the way, the millennials of Generation X are now in charge of the workplace. It represents 68% of the workforce. And, you know, we're dying off and we're less than 29% of the workforce right now. They want to work with others. I think the problem with millennials, we really coddle them. You got a trophy, even if you were in last place. They want to go right from, hi, I just got hired at Continental Bank, and now I'm president of Continental Bank.
Yeah,
from the beginning.
Yeah, but that's what I was going to say. I push back on, the millennials I know followed the same suit.
Right.
They just say that there might be a different interpretation on what's good salary or appreciation or support from colleagues. They have a different understanding of what that means than your generation.
Absolutely, because we were willing to accept much, much lower
Maybe
pay.
They're just not taking it anymore.
They're not taking it anymore because they've been raised. I mean, what you have in millennials is Generation X children and actually my grandchildren saying, well, you live in an upper middle class house. That's how I want to start, too. Well, you know, that doesn't always happen. But the reality is, I think all of these, the labor force and all these generations really is now really looking for something beyond the paycheck. Yes, I want to make money, but I also want to do something that is personally satisfying and perhaps makes a contribution to others. And more I see that, and certainly Loyola's at the Quinlan School, we're very concerned about the whole person, not just an education, that a life for others is part of it. Because when Adam Smith, and I think he's much maligned, and I think he's abused in our understanding of capitalism, when he said the purpose of production is consumption, he meant we make things so people could have things, not simply for the selfishness of it, and that we make things because there's a joy in making them, and we all have a better life because of it.
It's always a pleasure, man. Always great to have you, Al.
It's a pleasure to be
with you. I can tell from the text and people that call in, they love listening to you here on the download. So I appreciate you coming in with these thoughtful ideas.
It's my pleasure, and it's my work, and because of that, I enjoy it.
Al Genie, the resident philosopher here on the download, talking about May Day, International Workers' Day, the right to work and the right to not work here in human, not just here, but in around the world, human society. He's the professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University Chicago, and also the author of My Job, Myself, Work, and the Creation of the Modern Individual. You can check out his page, algenie.net. Al, great to see you. Thanks for being here.
See you soon. The Bears are here today, doing it for their fans, and what they want to say is
download here on 720 WGN, From Work to Work. Yes, the Chicago Bears had a very interesting draft, much maligned. So interesting that so many pundits, fans, in bystanders, people don't even like football, are like, yeah, what a terrible draft for the Bears. I don't see it that way, and I'm glad to see that Adam Hoge at WGN Radio Sports doesn't as well. He had a great piece he put up on WGNRadio.com, which is really about the 10 thoughts on what happened with the draft, a wild, wild Bears draft. He's on the line with us now. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Justin.
All right, so let's talk about this piece. I love it. I mean, right off the bat, you know, there really seemed to be a lot of consternation about the Bears moving up to be able to pick Trubisky. We were on the air when that happened, but really just about how John Lynch of the 49ers fleeced Ryan Pace, that he got the better of the deal, and what were the Bears thinking? You sort of go into investigative or reporter mode, and you kind of come up with the idea that that might not be the case.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you have to let this stuff play out. And I think probably even in the moment, on Thursday night when we were on the air, I was a little bit guilty of saying, wow, that's kind of a lot to move up one spot. But when you really put it in the history of the NFL draft and moves that have been made to go up and get a quarterback in the first round, the Bears really did not give up that much. I mean, you can just look at last year and see what the Rams gave up to get to number one to get Goff, and what the Eagles gave up to go to number two to get Carson Wentz, and they gave up future first round picks, and the Bears didn't have to do that. Didn't even have to come close to that. So you can go even farther. What did the Giants had to give up a haul to get Eli Manning from the Chargers at number one a long time ago, and even what the Chargers gave up to trade up to get Ryan Leaf back in 1998. Right. It was a, we included players and a couple first round picks. So, I mean, really in the history, if you stack this up with the history of the NFL, there really was not a lot to give up. And then there's also this idea of, okay, John Lynch totally outsmarted Ryan Pace here. And we learn, if you read Peter King's outstanding story on the Monday Morning Quarterback this morning, you learned because Peter King was actually in the building inside the 49ers draft room that really John Lynch was guessing too. He thought Ryan Pace was jumping up to get Solomon Thomas. I think, which a lot of us maybe thought that's what was going on. But and so he was prepared to take Reuben Foster at number 3.
Wow.
And guess what? No one drafted Reuben Foster, and the 49ers ended up getting him at 31. So that's how close John Lynch was
from here to go,
completely
right.
Overdrafting a guy that had character concerns and injury concerns. So look, they're all guessing. And so let's kind of break down more what Ryan Pace's thought process was here, and you kind of understand what he did.
It's great. It's a great piece on WGNRadio.com. You can read it right now. I really liked what Ryan Pace had to say, not unlike what you had to say about Mitchell Trubisky. Just the idea, you know, we lose sight of this because we all get caught up in numbers, but it's really about finding the right skill set for the NFL. There's always about, you know, Deshaun Watson's a great example, the quarterback out of Clemson, where they say, well, I'm not sure if his skill set applies to a faster game at the NFL, but Mitchell Trubisky's does.
Yeah, and I just saw a tweet a little while ago that came across my timeline that, man, the Bears just drafted the third-team all-ACC quarterback. Like, he wasn't even the second-team all-ACC. Well, the first two were Heisman finalists in Lamar Jackson and Deshaun Watson. So that doesn't really mean anything. I mean, this is – how many Heisman Trophy winners become, you know, Hall of Fame quarterbacks? I mean, it certainly happened in the past, but it doesn't happen a whole lot. And there's plenty of guys that go on and don't even do anything in the NFL. This is about projecting to the NFL level with NFL skill set, how a guy translates to an NFL offense. And Mitch Trubisky has all of those traits. What I particularly love that was why I had him ranked so highly and gave him a first-round grade was his poise in the pocket. He feels pressure. He's able to sidestep pressure. That's an instinctual trait in quarterbacks that really cannot be taught. It's just something you sort of have or you don't. And you can look at Jay Cutler and argue that throughout his career, he did not have that because when things started to break down, despite his athleticism, despite his strong arm, he often made mistakes. And I go back to Mitch Trubisky's 5-1 touchdown to turnover ratio this year, and it's pretty impressive considering what he was doing at North Carolina.
Adam, it's kind of like Moneyball in a way. You know, I mean, you're looking at the skills of these quarterbacks and how they fit into what you like. This is all analytics. This is all data. This is at a certain point, it's not even about what you did on the field. It's sort of how you plant your feet, things like that. I mean, it's crazy to think that's how the NFL has progressed, but it is.
No, it absolutely is. And when it comes down to it, whether it's quarterback or any other position, these guys who spend as much time as they do, and it's a year-round job for the college scouting department inside every NFL office. This is a year-round thing. And when it comes down to it, they get there in the moment when they're on the clock, and they may be 100% convinced that this guy's going to be a good pro, and the numbers say that, well, 50% of the time they're wrong, which is crazy when you really put it that way and you break it down. So, and I think it's even harder at the quarterback position to project these guys to the next level. So what I, you know, just in what I do for a living, I try to look at the process, you know, how a team arrived at a certain player. Was it well thought out or not? Were the traits actually there? Can you see them? And if it's a reach, like, you know, the Shea McClellan thing really kind of never made sense in the Bears defense. You know, you can look at that and question it. And you can also go back and look at the Kyle Fuller pick. And I actually like Kyle Fuller, so I didn't dog that, but you can criticize the Bears for not going up and getting their guy in Aaron Donald when they had the opportunity to trade up. They didn't, and they lost him right before the Bears picked, and they ended up with Kyle Fuller in 2014. So those are things that I think you can really criticize a GM for when you look back on it. The way the Bears handled this one, I get it.
Yeah, it's weird. Are you surprised at all at the way that the fan base, the analysts, the national ESPN guy, everyone in between has said that the Bears missed on this draft? Are you surprised?
I'm not surprised by the national reaction because, and I wrote about this a little bit today in my piece, I think we all tend to grade drafts and react to drafts so much off of what we think is going to happen ahead of time, right? And when we're completely blindsided by something, I think the natural reaction is to criticize it because you think a GM's just kind of going rogue, right? And right. and thinking outside the box. So to get the national reaction for as much as these guys put in the effort to try to get scoops and find out what's going on, and let's remember, like right as the draft was starting and we went on the air, Adam Schefter was reporting that the Bears were trying to trade back, not up. So everyone was caught off guard by this. So I'm not surprised by the national reaction. What I am surprised, and you know this, Justin, here in this city, the lack of good quarterbacks that goes back decades for the Chicago Bears. I am surprised that there's a GM in town right now that is clearly trying to fix that spot. Go out and give money to a quarterback that he thinks has upside in Mike Glennon, and then come back and make sure he doesn't miss on the guy he really truly believes is the franchise quarterback in Mitch Trubisky that can win this team a Super Bowl. I'm surprised there's so much backlash by the fan base because they've been trying to drive Jay Cutler out of town forever. Now he is gone, and what? They don't want the GM to replace him? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it doesn't, and it throws me. Okay, last question just about the other draft picks. I mean, you know, if you had to pick one guy in the later drafts, you know, whether it be Shaheen or Jackson or even the human joystick, where do you think the Bears struck gold? Where do you think that the Bears were ahead of the curve when it came to some of their late round picks?
Well, this is actually more based off of things I've been told over the weekend and the amount of praise that one of these prospects has gotten more than my own evaluation of him. But I heard a ton of positive things about Adam Shaheen over the weekend. And we had his head coach at Ashland on our show on Saturday, and I realized that coaches are always going to hype up their players. I get that. But he compared Adam Shaheen to Orlando Pace and Jason Taylor in terms of the potential he has as a pro. And the reason he picked those two players was because Lee Owens, this head coach, coached them back in the day in college. So he knows them. And that's how much he's hyping Adam Shaheen up. So if there's one guy that I think maybe could emerge out of this as really a true steal in the draft based off a lot of conversations I had over the weekend, I think it might be Shaheen.
All right. Adam Hoge, great piece on WGNRadio.com right now, giving his thoughts on the Bears draft over the weekend. We'll be covering the rookie camp that's coming up here, and then, of course, the offseason activities of the Chicago Bears. Adam, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin.
All right, it's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up tonight in Studio 435, the band Molehill here. They're setting up as we speak. Some good synth sounds. Excited about the synth. We don't get too much synth up in here. Always fun. Also, we'll get you up to speed on who won the James Beards tonight. That's coming up after 9:30. And, of course, much, much more with the news with Rob and Esmeralda and traffic, things like that. 13th Annual Midwest Independent Film Festival is presenting its, this is amazing to me, first ever animation showcase. Mm-hmm. It's going to be the Landmark up in Lakeview tomorrow night. You know, I think about that. Mike McNamara is here. Mike, a frequent guest here on the download. Good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you, brother. Thanks for having me.
You know, the first ever animation series. I mean, you put on so many different independent films, mm-hmm. and you showcase so many different styles of film, from comedy to different genres.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe that you have not had an animation. It's 13 years.
And we looked at it, and we've shown. We'll put an animated short into a shorts program here and there, but we hadn't had a night. And people had asked for it, and I was like, well, if we're going to do it, we got to have an hour and a half of the baddest content out there. This has to be a blowout. We're not going to kind of limp in with, well, here's 40 minutes. It has to be just an absolute blowout. And a couple films came together, one of whom I brought the filmmaker with me here tonight, came together. I'm like, I think we've got it. I think we have this animation showcase. And the gentleman with me.
Our star is here, Carter Boyce. He's the director of Defluked. Is that right? Did I get it right?
Yeah, Defluked.
Defluked, which won a 2016 Student Academy Award, a student at DePaul University, Chicago. And Carter, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really excited about it.
So let's talk about this. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, so we have Carter's film, which, I mean, this is the Oscars for the student category, you know. So it pretty much beat out all the other films in the country. And Carter's Chicago, also Champaign, you know, Illinois guy. And this is the Chicago premiere of this film. This is your first chance to see this on the big screen. It's a five-minute short. So this is going to be alongside 14 other shorts. That's the first half of the program. And then the second half of the program, we have a 45-minute animated feature called Where It Floods from Joel Benjamin. And it's the world premiere of that. So, like, top to bottom,
great
it's just
stuff.
A blowout.
All right, Carter, let me ask you, what comes first, filmmaking or animation? For you, is there a certain – what's the draw to doing your storytelling, your filmmaking and animation?
So I would say that my desire to do filmmaking kind of led me to animation. It wasn't something that I'd always, like, really wanted to do, but my brother is a filmmaker, just announced, like, his first feature film on Sunday at C2E2, which is really exciting. I worked on that, worked on the teaser they did for that a little bit, and but, you know, he's always been into it, and that kind of inspired me. But then I wasn't sure what to do, so, like, I kind of thought about animation, and I went to school for it. And I just fell in love with it. And, like, that kind of, like, surpassed, like, at that time I didn't, film was just like I kind of wanted, that seems cool. So, but I fell in love with animation because, well, 3D animation specifically, as a child, I would, like, build stuff out of whatever I could find. You know, I took apart our VCRs and, like, took all of our Tupperware and built boats out of motors and, like, all this crap and, like... So
I'm sure the parents loved that.
Oh yeah, man, they were huge fans. So 3D animation basically allowed me to do that with like almost like an adult tool set, right? Like I just had anything that I wanted to be able to build this stuff. So it was like I just fell in love with it and I worked on it every day. Even like when I finished my first 2 years of school, I took a few years off, you know, but I still worked on it every single day. And then my desire to actually make films and like it kind of slowly came on, but like I wanted to tell stories with it more and more and more. And then I went to DePaul and they really, really inspired me to like learn what it takes to make a story.
Well, let me ask you, I'm interested. So you could really be into the technique of 3D animation without being a filmmaker. You could just do 3D animation. You could work on just the idea of just being an animator. But the filmmaking part is when it comes together to tell a story.
Oh yeah, definitely. And it's really cool because you have so many. You can incorporate that love for just like the technique, and just be able to present it in a way that people can really relate to, which is something that's really interesting with my film, is that at first it was going to just be, a little backstory. My film is actually about a kinetic sculpture that breaks down and the character comes to life and finishes the cycle he was destined to be on forever. So at first I didn't have a story for it. And basically I was just going to make a kinetic sculpture, something I would have built as a child. That was like my goal, was I was like, I want to take this back to my childhood, something that inspired me to do this. And it was, I was just going to do a cool video of a kinetic sculpture. And then my friend at the time kind of like gave me this idea for these two ornaments to be on it, which was a boy and following this balloon, right? So at that point, it was still just going to be a video of a kinetic sculpture. But then it was like, oh, wait. The boy, what if it breaks down and this boy comes to life and finishes it? Like, it's perfect. And so, like, that story came out of it. And it was so incredible because the story allowed, you know, my artwork to capture people and not only, like, and to actually appreciate the technique of doing, you know, 3D animation, and also, like, you know, feel for this character and, like, the environment and...
Carter Boyce is the filmmaker of Defluked, which will be part of the animation showcase at the Midwest Independent Film Festival tomorrow night at the Landmark right there on Clark Street.
Yep, 6 p.m.
All right, Mike, when you talk about animation in the Midwest, because it's all about Midwest stuff, I mean, animation, of course, you know, there's Hollywood has just factories for animation, of course, when all these things. Talk about the relationship. I mean, what are you seeing from animation in the Midwest? Is it mostly through students and universities, or is there a strong, robust sort of animation community here?
There really is a robust animation community, and it took us a little while to find it. That's why it took us 13 years before we said, okay, we have the best, because we didn't want it to just be a night of student films, because obviously you have those resources around you in that college university environment, so it's a little more readily available, and you're on deadline. You know, the feature that we're premiering tomorrow night as well, the 45-minute one, it took him 8 years to make that film. That's the other part of animation. You know, if you're shooting a live-action film, we're going to shoot a little romantic comedic short, 15 minutes. Honestly, you can knock that out in a long weekend. Do you know what I mean? Now, you got to get a whole heck of a lot of people together, but you can knock that out in a weekend. Right. You can edit it over the next month. And
but there's an amount of time that goes into animating anything.
You have to invest every ounce of your soul into it. And the thing with technology today, you're working on this on your laptop. So day at work, you come back, the laptop's sitting there. You got that little short film. When you go to work on me? When you go to work on me?
You know, it's interesting, Carter, when I think about animation, and I don't know much about the community or even really about the technique, but I'll just automatically, my brain goes to drawing.
Yeah.
The idea that, you know, has it been done throughout ages, is it's been cartoons, you know, and
definitely.
Yeah. Is that still the base idea of animation with all the technology, with the 3D, everything involved with it, where you can use computers? Is drawing still the element, the base element of animation?
In certain ways, yeah. I mean, every technique that they used to figure out how to do hand-drawn animation is still used. Mm. And people think that, like, with a computer, you can, you know, set the animation at one point to be here, and then at, you know, 24 frames later, it would be there.
Right.
And then the computer will do the rest. But that's not how it works. I mean, every frame is meticulously looked at, and you go through every single frame. You just keep pressing that button to go to the next frame to make sure everyone is perfect. And, you know, with, like, with hand-drawn animation, they had to make sure that the pose of the character would present itself in a way that people could understand it. That's how you do it still. You do that with 3D animation still.
And when you're learning about animation through schools or universities, I mean, is there really a lot dedicated to the history of how they came to this? I mean, are there sort of animators that you study that you're inspired by that may have done it in a much more analog way than the digital ways of today?
Yeah. I mean, I would say, I mean, one of my biggest inspirations, which he was like, he studied the way, like, you know, the nine animators from Disney, like, and Walt Disney himself, like, the way that they did things, he studied them meticulously. And that's John Lasseter. He started Pixar, right? He is one of the biggest inspirations, because of the way that he developed his technique and his true, you know, passion for the art form and sticking to, what it means to tell good story. That is his number one rule, is to tell the story well. Mm-hmm. But also his dedication to it, you know, like when he was doing, I mean, when he made Toy Story, he did what I had to do when I was making Defluked, and that was sleep at his desk for 2 hours and then wake up and keep working for 30 or 40 hours. And
that's how Justin does the show, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take a nap in a second, right? And the band comes in.
So, yeah, I mean, like, it's all about the respect for the people that came before you, because, like, that's what, I mean, that's what filmmaking is as a whole.
Mike, you know, doing the Midwest Independent Film Festival, and you do it once a month on Tuesdays.
All year round, every first Tuesday.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the themes that come out of there are about sort of the idea of an independent filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't necessarily have to go to Hollywood. You don't have to go knock on doors of studios. I mean, there are ways to create this art outside of the system, and you're encouraging that and promoting it and fostering it in Chicago, but it's the Midwest.
Yep.
For animation, like you just said with Lasseter, I mean, those are, I mean, you really are. I mean, I know some people who are in animation or have done some things, and they I mean, you're talking about Pixar and other places. These are like animators are in desks and cubicles, like mm-hmm. we would have insurance companies here. You know, like all it's right. just like it's a. So the question I have is there a way that Chicago can have an animation community, an independent animation community outside of Hollywood, or is this the classic? If you want to be in this business, if you want to have success as an animator, you have to go west.
Well, we've really decentralized the industry, the film industry, in the last 10 years more than ever. So the bottom line is if we're making great content here, we can build that community here. And that doesn't mean we're not working with the big houses on the West Coast and a little bit in the East Coast, but mostly on the West Coast. But we can really, if the talent stays here in Chicago, you know, they can be coming to us to work with us. And the beauty is just with all of the independent distribution channels that are out there now, et cetera, you know, we can really, you can put your own content out there. You know, 10 years ago, the only way you could get a film out there was through the big houses yeah. and to be in the big theaters. Now, if Carter wanted to, he could put his film out on Vimeo on demand and sell it himself and distribute it himself. And he can create a channel for his own content.
Is the next move, Carter? I mean, as you wrap up your collegiate career, as you move on and as a filmmaker, is it to move west? Is it to try and get in the door in Los Angeles and Hollywood?
It's interesting that you actually bring this up because this is where I am. Like, this is my endeavor that I'm working on right now. And I'm working on it hard. I'm working on it, 50 hours a week. And, I'm not going out there. I'm saying, yeah. I mean, to hell with that. Like, I want to stay here and work with people that I love, from the Midwest. And that place is so saturated and everybody's in the film industry out there. But I was lucky enough to actually meet a producer out there who has that same sort of vision for the Midwest. And his name is John B. Carls. And he actually put the team together and kind of led them to create the movie Rango. And that movie won the best animation in 2012, best feature animation. So he came to me and he's like, I really want to build this studio out in the Midwest. And I was like, oh, I really want to stay out in the Midwest. And he's like, all right. And but he loves my film a lot. And he met me through a lady named Bonnie Lee, and she was actually the lady who found Tim Burton. And she hit me up while I was in L.A. for the awards week, and she was like, I really want to help you do this. And I was like, I really want you to help me do this.
And, what a coincidence. Right,
that works.
You want to help me, I want help.
But that's good to know.
The Midwest Independent Film Festival is dedicated to filmmakers like Carter, the people that are staying here, building the community here, doing great work here, and we're celebrating the best filmmaking talent that we have in the Midwest. But Carter, tomorrow night, all the filmmakers are going to be there. Yeah. He's going to meet a few collaborators tomorrow night that he doesn't know, and hopefully continue to build that collaboration team, here in the Midwest.
The Midwest Independent Film Festival will be doing their first ever animation showcase at the Landmark Century Center Cinema. It's right there on Clark Street, Diversity and Clark Street, in Lakeview. That is tomorrow. At 6 o'clock?
6 o'clock. So doors open at 6 and the films start at 7:30. So we have a pre-show kind of reception from 6 to 7:30. We also have a panel right in the middle of that. And I don't know if we're going to a break or what have you, but it's there's a film that nobody's heard of because it's been very much kind of hush-hush, but it was just accepted into the Cannes Film Festival, the biggest film festival in the world. It's called They. And it was made right here in Chicago last summer. And we have the director, Anahita Gazvanizadeh. I can say that 10 times fast. She's going to be there with her producer as part of our panel tomorrow night.
That's great.
To kick off the night. And this is the first that anyone's really heard from Anahita. It's your first look at, hearing about her film before in a couple weeks where she'll be making its world premiere.
Love
at
it. All right. That's tomorrow night at the Landmark Century Cinema. Mike McNamara of the Midwest Independent Film Festival and Carter Boyce, who's the director of Deflooped, which will be shown tomorrow night. He's also the 2016 Student Academy Award winner for Deflooped. Thanks, you guys, for coming in. Good luck with the show and good luck with your career as well.
Thank you.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having us.
All right. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Both the Chicago baseball teams really kind of starting the week off poorly. The White Sox are down in the eighth, 6-1. The Royals look like they're going to add on to that. And the Cubs, Pete, down 7-0 at home at Wrigley to the Phillies in the third inning.
Yeah. I don't even know. I looked up in the first, you know, we went through the hour and a half rain delay, and then I looked up in the first inning, and it's still pouring rain.
They're just playing?
Yeah. This game should be under protest.
Are we at the point where we should tell the guys from Molehill to go home and just do 1.5 hours on what's wrong with the Cubs? No, we're not there yet.
No, not there yet.
Although this was 2 years ago, we would have totally done that.
Although when I looked up, I saw them saying something about the 27 the World Series last year, and I was getting mad at Joe Madden for his handling of the pitching staff in the World Series.
They don't mention that part, right? All right, so the Cubs and the Sox both losing on a Monday. That's okay though; it's early in the week. The James Beard Awards just happened at the Lyric Opera here in Chicago. This is a big weekend. We kind of talked about this. This is the Oscars of food. The food industry, the culinary industry from around the country come into Chicago this weekend. Last night I had the chance to go gallivant. I was gallivanting all over
really?
Town. Really? Yeah. Or you know what? Maybe I was traipsing. you go one way or the other. Gallivanting or traipsing, I don't remember. Yeah, but I got to go out to sort of a little bit of the pre because, as I mentioned, probably four times a week on this show that I am a James Beard Award winner.
That's right. That's right. Of course.
Two time.
So you're automatically eligible to go to all these places because you have an award.
Yeah. But you know what, though? I realized that I won my awards back in like 2000. It's been 17 years.
So?
It just means that I have to do a couple more emails than I should as a James Beard Award winner. If I had won maybe in 2012, they'd be like, Justin, you can do whatever you'd like. A 2000 winner, they're like, and you are?
Oh, that's a disgrace.
Yeah, so,
I mean, they still let Jack Nicholson into the Oscars if he wants to go, right?
That's true. But I went to Boca Restaurant, which up there in Halston. They had a great party. They do a whole thing with like Shake Shack and a couple other Bang Bang Pie. And then I went to Rick Bayless's party for Frontera Grill.
Oh,
it's
great.
30 anniversary, yeah. That's great. At the Modern Wing of the Art Institute.
Yeah.
If you've ever been in the hallway of the Modern Wing when you go in there, automatically, man, this would be a great party with finger food. First thing you think about. And that's what it was like. But all great chefs. And I have to say, Pete, the download, you know, we have a lot of these chefs, you know, have come on and had conversations. Even just last week, Rick was on with Bayless and... also Abe Conlin and Abraham Conlin and Adrian Lowe. And, you know, I got to see all the chefs. Erling Wu Bauer was there, Jason Hamill, Stephanie Izard. And so it was fun. Mindy Siegel. And so I go up to the thing and I kind of gingerly kind of like get their attention and, you know, they're busy. But I give them a wave and they're always like, hey.
Oh, great.
Yeah, they're like, hey, how's it going? How's the show? Everything. I'm always inviting them back, and they're like, yeah, sure. So it's nice. They give us a little bit of – they remember us. They remember their interviews.
They did? Yeah, great. Yeah. That's really good to hear.
Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. The ones that don't. Who are you? but it was fun. It was fun. I got to see a lot of great people. And then we went to the James Beard party, which is like the chef's night out. It's in on Fulton. And that's like the actual party, right? That's like the one that's more like the reception for the – I don't know who gets it. I don't know. Winners and nominees, things like that. And it was really fun because I walked in. My wife and I walked in, and it was raining, right? What else is new? And Andrew Zimmern from Strange Foods, is that what it is, right?
Yeah.
He's right there, and he goes, hey, good to see you. Like to me. And I've never had him on the show. I don't know. But I think he just defaults because everyone looks at him because he's a celebrity. Everyone knows. So he's like, I have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
I have a 50-50 choice. I can act like I've never met this person. If I have, I look like an ass.
Yep. Right?
Or I go the other route and act like I have met this person, and I'm not as much of an ass. So he went that route. So I was like, oh, and it made me feel like,
that's a better way to go.
Must recognize this mug, right? I'm going to take that from here on out.
Yeah.
From here on out, anyone I walk up anywhere, I'll be like, hey, how's it going, bud? Good to see you again. Just to see.
You know? I mean, I think maybe that your reputation has preceded you in the room.
They do. Maybe they all know I'm a two-time James Beard Award.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that could be. Anyway, it was a fun night. I have to say, the hardest part about that party is they always have, like, you know, there's like millions of bars. They set up bars everywhere, and every bar is a different vendor and a different alcohol. Mm-hmm. And it's not like you're boozing, you know. It's not like you're, but you're mixing your alcohol because you're like, oh, what do you have here? Oh, this is a nice, oh, this is a Chardonnay. Let me try this. Oh, the next time you're like, oh, this is a nice whiskey. Let me try. So before you know it, you're just like, you're not drunk, but you're kind of like, ah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that, so that's also like when I was walking home last night, I was like, ah, blah. So anyway, that was my experience.
You got to lay down a base of those finger foods.
I know. That was my mistake. I had during my Harry Potter weekend earlier, I had created a, whatever was left in the fridge, ham sandwich. It was dynamite. It was too big. So when I got to the finger food stuff at like 4 o'clock, I'm like, no, I'm not interested. I had a ham sandwich. I had a Jewel Osco ham sandwich.
Yeah.
So I missed that. But Amanda Puck was at the Chef's Night Out.
Oh, I love Amanda.
Yeah. And Amanda was sponsored by Mariano's and the whole bit. And she was like, we're doing karaoke tonight. This is a big party in front of like, you know, 700 people or whatever. And she's like, around 10 o'clock, we're going to do karaoke. She's like, and I'm like, well, I'm pretty good at it. I can do R. Kelly. I Believe I Can Fly, Bring the House Down. And she's like, great, great. I'm going to need you. And I'm like, I'm joking. The last thing I'm going to do at 10 o'clock is get up in front of every chef in Chicago and be like,
oh, man, that would have been good, though.
It would have been good, right. I got out of there before
that. Could use a viral hit.
That's right. All right, coming up, Molehill's here, and we'll talk about who won the James Beard Foundations. Let's go to a break. We'll come back. We'll get the winners. They've wrapped up there, so we'll read off who won and how Chicago fared. Sound good? It's a download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Molehill coming up at Studio 435. We get some live music. Setting up as we speak. The 2017 James Beard Foundation Restaurant and Chef Award winners are in. Of course, as we said, the Chicago was represented. Steve Dolinsky was on Friday. We talked a little bit about it. It's been better years for Chicago. You know, there were some
oversights, perhaps.
Oversights and best new restaurant. Steve thought that Oriole would be one that should have been up, and Food and Wine agreed, but the James Beard Foundation did not nominate Oriole from Chicago. Instead, the big winners tonight for Chicago in the category of, I mean, this is a huge one, right? I mean, this is
the best
outstanding restaurant. So there's best new restaurant and there's other, but the outstanding restaurant, the category of outstanding restaurant, Topolo Bampo from Chicago, Rick Bayless's restaurant, fine dining restaurant right next to Frontera Grill.
Got the Kaufman bump.
Yep, that's right.
Came out on Friday. Wins on Monday.
That's right.
That's how you do it. Take note, chefs.
Chefs came in. Rick was here on Thursday. Yeah, Thursday night. Yeah, but you're right. Yeah, he came on. So then, you know, they say, well, he must be a good chef if he's on the download. And he got the win.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. You'll like this, of course, in the regional categories. We were talking about the best chef, Great Lakes. This was all Chicago, right? You had everybody, really. Lee Wolin, Erling Wubauer.
Beverly Kim,
Abraham Conlin, Adrian Lowe, and Sarah Grunberg from Monteverde. And the winner for Best Chef Great Lakes tonight, Sarah Grunberg, Monteverde.
Congratulations.
Congratulations to her.
Also a guest
also
on
a
the
guest.
Show.
Yeah. She was great. She comes from the Spiaggia tree. Right? She was so that's great. Those are the worst part about it is that's it. For Chicago. That's it. Everyone else went to, we had winners from New York. You know, Pastry Chef went to New York. Outstanding Chef went to Philadelphia. Outstanding Bar Program went to New Orleans. Outstanding Baker, Washington, D.C. Outstanding Wine Program, Seattle.
What do they know?
What do they know? This is the part of the download every year that we go through and we... We second guess, we armchair quarterback based on just the reason. I haven't been to any of these restaurants, been to any of this stuff, but we just feel that the Chicago restaurants should have been nominated and won these categories.
We, you know, I went to New Orleans recently and, you know, you just, I made like 50 reservations just because I wasn't. There's so much good food, and I just wasn't sure how things would play out. So I make one for every hour of the day, like sure. 5 o'clock,
classic,
8 o'clock,
right,
10,
right.
You know, and then just kind of cancel them as we figure out what we're doing. And then there was one day that we were like, oh, let's just like, you know, let's kind of mull around the neighborhoods, go to like, you know, like dive bars and whatever. I'm like, yeah, all right, we'll cancel the reservation. And it turns out the reservation I canceled was for this restaurant, Herb Saint, which won like the best restaurant in the South, or she won best chef.
She did?
Yeah.
Oh, so you missed it.
Yeah, missed out on it. Hmm. Had a good veggie burger, though, from some bar.
Yeah. You're really down on yourself. You're down on your
choices.
It's
a bad decision.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so that's a bit, I mean, that's big. I mean, you've got, like you said, I mean, that's a big one to say Monteverde, Chicago. Now, they had outstanding, I believe, restaurant design we were up for in Chicago, and then also outstanding restaurateur was Kevin Bame and the crew from Boca, and they did not win. Steven Starr from Starr Restaurants, Philadelphia. Philadelphia. What is that?
Yeah.
That's not something you think about. It's not like you're sitting there going, man, you know where I get great food? Philadelphia. You know where I'd probably great restaurateurs? Philadelphia.
No.
That just feels like a New York James Beard nomination process. It's like, I'll go 60 miles, but that's about it. You know, how far is Philadelphia from New York?
It's close.
Right. It's ridiculous.
So you're saying there's a bias still in...
I'm not, you know, I don't want to be on the record. Don't put words in my... All right, this interview's done. That's my Trump. I'm done. It's over. And then he just sits down. Did you see the...
yeah.
The Face the Nation interview where Donald Trump said the interview's over. It was in the White House. It was in the Oval Office, wasn't yeah. it? The idea is that this interview's over, and he got up, and then he just, like, yeah. circled around and sat back down. Yeah.
And John Dickerson just standing there. Should I leave now? Should I escort myself out? Or how do we work the rest
that's
of this?
Kind of the best, that's kind of the best way to end an interview. Stand up, and then sit right back down, right? Oh, I'm done. That's just way to make an exit? Entrance? Anyway. Yeah, so that James Beard tonight. So that does it for another James Beard. I mean, that's not a great haul for Chicago, but to have outstanding restaurant, we'll take that with Topolobampo.
Yeah, that's great.
And the best chef was going to be from the Great Lakes. It was going to be from Chicago. All the nominees were.
Wonder if we'll see like any of those, any like a Sarah Gruenberg kind of bump up to be nominated for, you know, best chef.
Yeah, best
all
chef
over.
Yeah. Well, they you'll love this outstanding chef. The like all over. Was Michael Solomonov from Philadelphia.
Another Philadelphia guy?
It was like the one year that I went crazy when the guy from Cleveland won. I don't even know. The restaurants could be the best restaurants in the history of the world.
Yeah, they could be. They're probably good.
I judge it just based solely and ignorantly on the town itself. I don't think anyone should win best anything from Philadelphia, right?
You don't, yeah, I mean, you're right. You don't think of Philadelphia. I mean, I'm sure there's fine restaurants there.
Philly wants to be Chicago.
You don't,
first,
yeah.
First, they take the NFL draft. Yeah. Now they're winning Outstanding Chef when everyone knows the Outstanding Chefs are here in Chicago.
I wouldn't be surprised if you look up the lineage, perhaps, of these chefs. I bet you they started in New York.
I thought maybe they started in Chicago. Yeah, you're absolutely right. They did. Yeah.
Whatever. Moved over. But yeah, great for Rick.
312 is mad at me because I called Andrew Zimmern's show Strange Foods. It's Bizarre Foods.
Oh, it is Bizarre Foods, yeah.
Yeah, and he's mad at me.
Oh.
Well. It's that tone, that text tone. You can feel it. He's sitting in their chair all mad.
I'm surprised that you didn't know that since he's your buddy.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I do like that show. There's no doubt. I do like the Bizarre Foods. I just didn't know the name. I also like River Monsters, and I'd rather watch that. That's it's kind of my go-to on the Discovery Channel, wherever that's at, right? Travel Channel. So if Bizarre Foods is on right after River Monsters, I'm in. You know, I usually will spend all of my time based on what like my television habits around when River Monsters is on. Like, I'm not going to time shift. I'm not going to on-demand that one. That one, boom. If it's on 8 o'clock...
You're sitting down?
Yep. So there might be some crossover, you know, whatever's on at 9 o'clock on Animal Planet or Travel Channel, whatever it's on.
gets my eyeballs for 5 minutes, right? So there it is. All right, the band Molehill coming up here, Studio 435. I'm excited. We got a huge week this week. I mean, there's so much great stuff that's coming up on the download. And we're going to get to it this week.
I know. It's our second week in a row, five in a row.
I know, right? No Blackhawks, so we're on until October or whenever they come back, September, right?
Something like that.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's exciting to get, you know, sort of. Yeah, I mean, you get
momentum.
You get some continuation, and you know, we'll start talking about certain things. Now you can recognize that, you know, we have a shared hatred of Philadelphia. So we just keep bringing that up every night, right? Does that work? We can just keep bringing it up.
Yeah, I'll go. I mean, right now the Phillies are in town beating up on the Cubs.
Oh, I guess you're right. Yeah. Tomorrow night, Tim King's going to join us. The longtime principal in town. We'll talk to him about his graduation rate at Urban Prep. Also, Alpina Singh's going to join us. A longtime restaurateur here in Chicago, mm-hmm. who I saw last night as well.
Went to her Terra and Vine up in Evanston a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Delightful.
Yeah, she's becoming a powerhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we'll play the worst. Like I said, we'll play also this week Richard E. Grant.
Wow.
He is starring in My Fair Lady here in Chicago, and he's going to come in and sit down at the big table, which is great. How great is that? Right?
That's some A-listers.
A-list! So we got a lot of good stuff coming up this week. All right, so we'll take a break. We'll come back. Molehill will be here. They are setting up as we speak, and we will be ready to let them loose here on the download. Stay with us. All right, thanks, Rob. It's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's Monday night, so that means it's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of live music here in our Allstate Showcase studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. Tonight, the progressive pop sounds of the band Molehill. They have a brand new EP out this month called Hearts on Fire. They've released a couple of those tracks already. You can find them on streaming sites like iTunes, Spotify. Tomorrow night, they're going to be at Subterranean, the great little club there in Wicker Park. In studio tonight, the band Peter Manhart, Trevor Jones, Greg Van Zuden, and Devin Staples. Guys, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
There was like a nice little snicker in the air when I said progressive pop. How do you guys classify your music? Because I've kind of been joking all night about this, sort of like there's a lot of synth, which I really like.
Yeah, I mean, tonight we brought in all the synths because the last time we came in here, I think we really punished this room with the live drum kit. No, we always joke around with progressive because, I suppose some of our older songs are more progressive, but we have purposely tried on some songs just to use pretty limited harmonic language, like four chords, write the best melody that you can.
Right.
And somehow people are like, oh, yeah, they're progressive. I'm like, God, there's just...
Why did they do that? Because of the synth? Because it's the electronic sound?
We always have this theory that like any harmony that has this... I know this is kind of music nerd stuff, no. But any harmony that's like above a triad, so like a seventh or a ninth that sounds even slightly exotic, people are like, oh man, that's kind of progressive. or I have this other theory that if like anyone can like play their instrument even to like a... just like a basic level, it's like, oh man,
very progressive.
Yeah, progressive rock. I'm like, yeah, I don't know, but I mean, some songs I think we definitely do deserve the progressive title, but other stuff I don't know why.
Yeah, I was saying, I think it's like you do one song that's progressive and then you're just a progressive
yeah
band.
Right,
it's everything that you do now is progressive. I'm not sure why.
Well, I mean,
I'm
what cool would you classify yourself, just a rock band?
Alternative rock, I think.
Yeah. It's either got to be alternative, indie, or progressive. It has to be one of those three, right?
It's funny because I've had so many bands in here, and I always feel like at the beginning I have this conversation because I'll say the indie rock sounds, and then last week after we were talking with whoever, it was really just about indie just means you're not on a record label, like a major record label. So that's everybody at this point, right? Yeah. And that's like indie rock is not a thing anymore because indie, that just isn't a thing. That just is a mainstream.
Yeah, I think when... Who was it? Jesse Menendez said we were, it's like cinematic.
Yeah.
Or some
yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, something along those lines. But you know, we like writing big music with good melodies. That's like kind of it.
Where did you guys get together?
Here in Chicago. It was kind of a random, a lot of word of mouth. I started the band with different musicians, and then kind of one by one, these guys all came on board, and now we've been the four of us for 7 years now at this point.
When you're getting together, because, you know, and I asked this question it's such an ethereal question, but when you get together, do you have to have similarities in the kind of music that you like to be able to create a sound that you guys create with Molehill? I mean, the idea being that, I mean, are you the kind of band that every member that comes in, Devin comes in or Trevor comes in, and you all have different sounds and it sort of makes its own sound? Or do you really have to be sort of on the same page when it comes to the kind of music you want to play?
I think there's got to be some common threads, yeah. You know, and then each of us probably has our own offshoot that we bring to the mix, but we probably all connect in a center place, and then it goes from there. Yeah.
Yeah, there have to be elements. You know, it's like if we listen to a lot of stuff, you know, sometimes you'll sit there and listen to, you know, a band or whatever, and you'll hear something in the production that you really like a hi-hat pattern or a bass tone or the lead singer's, you know, like quality of their voice. But there has to be something.
Right.
You know, you can't butt heads. But we've definitely... That was a struggle early on, because it's not that we didn't appreciate the same music, but it was tough getting on the same page with what we wanted to do.
So. Yeah, a lot of bands. I've been thinking about this recently, because another friend of ours who's in a band said to me one time that the hardest part about starting a band is finding a bunch of guys that want to play the same kind of music as you. And a lot of bands, you know, they'll put out an ad like, you know, we're right. into this or that band, and these are the kind of influences we have. We weren't like that. It was more like, okay, you're a good musician. You can commit to a band. Let's start there. And then we kind of had these growing pains of like figuring out, okay, now what kind of music do we all like? And it was...
So commitment comes first, especially when you're talking about, you know, committing to a quartet, if you will, of musicians. There's so much time that goes into rehearsal, and to actually say you want to be a part of this moving forward. That's more than half the battle.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we always say every year it seems like there are at least two or three bands that we know that have broken up, you know, for a bunch of different reasons, mostly just, I don't know. I'm not those people. But yeah, it's tough to keep it together every day. I mean, whenever Peter and I see each other, like at the last day of tour or whatever, usually the parting words are, yeah, man, I'll probably talk to you tomorrow.
That's good.
Yeah, there's always something to do. That no one, you know, it doesn't matter who you're working with. If someone else cares more than you, that's a problem.
You know, and we'll take a break here, and then we'll hear some live music. But is that what drives you guys? A passion to be a part of this band? A passion to produce this kind of music?
Oh, for sure. And just having. You know, just being able to wake up and produce music, write music, you know, that's me personally. That's what drives me, you know, knowing that every morning I can get up, write, create music, play drums, and just be a part of a great band playing with great musicians, just enjoying the whole musicianship, you know.
Well, that's great. Molehill is the band in studio, the cinematic pop. Band, how about that? The sounds,
I'll take it.
Cinematic pop sounds of Molehill. All right, the EP, which is sort of out in the sense that you're releasing tracks, throughout May. The full EP will be out by the end of the month, probably.
Yeah, May 12th, whole thing will be out. Yeah.
Hearts on Fire, you can find it on iTunes, other places that stream. They're going to be at Subterranean in Wicker Park tomorrow night. Peter Manhart, Trevor Jones, Greg Van Zuten, and Devin Staples in studio. We'll take a break. We'll get a sound check. We'll hear some live music from Molehill. Stay with us. All right, it's the download here on 720 WGN, Studio 435, our Monday night showcase. Live music here in Chicago in the Allstate Showcase Studio along Michigan Avenue tonight. The cinematic pop sounds of the band Molehill.
They got a brand new EP coming out this month, May 12th, Hearts on Fire. They've released a few tracks already. Tomorrow they're going to be at Subterranean in Wicker Park, but tonight they are here. Peter Manhart, Trevor Jones, Greg Van Zuiden, and Devin Staples in studio. Here they are with the song The Repeating. Take it away, guys. Studio tonight, Studio 435 here on beautiful Michigan Avenue in the city of Chicago, Molehill. The new EP, Hearts on Fire. Come on back down to the microphones. We'll talk a little bit more. The new EP comes out May 12th. Some of the tracks are out already. You can find them streaming sites everywhere. The tomorrow night, they're going to be at Subterranean Wicker Park. Peter Manhart, Trevor Jones, Greg Van Zuiden, and Devin Staples. Yeah, the music, I mean, it's interesting because we could call it cinematic pop, but a lot of what we hear there is sort of electronica in the way it's probably, maybe that's not the right term anymore. Maybe I moved on, but the idea of you're using the drum pad, you know, the bass is keys, you know, there's a lot of sort of synth going on in this song. Where does that come from you guys as musicians? Does it start with having an interest in that kind of music and going there? Or, I mean, does it come out of sort of a more traditional training? Where does it come from?
Well, we should clarify, when we play live, it's definitely a full drum kit, bass guitar. It's definitely more of a rock sound. But for this setting, we actually wanted to try this, like, all synth.
This is the first time we've ever done this with the...
Yeah. Oh, really? So, yeah, it's pretty fun.
All right. That's awesome.
No, I mean, I think collectively, we've always been, you know, we always joke with Devin. You know, we'll be, like, working on a new song, and Devin will be like, man, Trev, if you could... man, you know, just working some of those sonic textures.
And, sonic textures.
And it could mean anything. It could be like a little slide on the bass. But the funny thing is, we'll always try out a bunch of stuff. And you know it's right when Devin just looks over. He's like, yep, that's what it was. But no, to answer your question, I guess... no, I mean, we all came up on, like, guitar-based music for sure. But, you know, it seems like to a certain degree, maybe like the most creative music that's coming out right now in some ways is being done in that, you know, like pop, hip hop world that uses, you know, just lots of electronics. And I'm not like trying to say there's not really great stuff coming out in every single genre, but
right.
we definitely listen to, you know, a lot of music that is outside of what we write.
Yeah. I personally have been getting way more into electronic music, in the last, even like, I don't know, 5-6 years or something, like heavy, like EDM stuff.
Yeah.
And
right.
then like, you know, a tons of, the music you just hear in mainstream pop, just like Trevor was saying, or rock, a lot of it has a lot of more electronic influences these days too.
And I mean, you hear that. I mean, it's very interesting, like pop music right now. And I hear it all the time. I have a 9-year-old. So you listen to like, even the stuff that's on Kiss FM, the addition of electronica, like a track that's in the, that's on the hook or something that's definitely built from synthesized, you know, it's not just sort of a straight ahead guitar riff anymore. There's this, I think of bands, I don't even know the names of them, but I can tell you that every song from Justin Bieber down is doing something with electronica yeah. music behind them that is changing the genre.
Yeah. I believe the reason is because now, you can have a 15-year-old kid who can go to Guitar Center and buy this software, this music software called Fruity Loops. And like your 9-year-old probably can learn how to make a track from it. So that's why you hear
yeah.
like a lot of this.
Is it changed the music? I mean, is it changed in the sense that a lot of non-musicians don't go through the sort of traditional, like you're a drummer. I mean, you have to understand music and time and everything that goes into it. I mean, does it change the music that someone at 10 years old can go to the Guitar Center and be like, I'll buy that?
No, I mean, a 10-year-old's always been able to play music in some way. I think, I mean, there are pros and cons. They're all just tools, you know, like buying a software package. The best part about it is, at least on my end, is I have more sounds than I'll ever be able to go through in my life. But the problem is that anyone can buy those sounds. So to make something that's really striking and unique, you still have to have
the creativity.
Something inside you that you want to get out. But you know, when you buy these like preloaded software packages like Fruity Loops, guess what? Everyone's got the same kick sound. Everyone's got the same synth sound. Now you can manipulate those. You can build those from scratch. And, you know, I still think people know it to a degree when they hear something that's just like really striking and unique. And that's a hard thing to do.
I mean, there's something to be said about the music that is being consumed at the pop music level. Those are hooks. I mean, those are the same hooks that musicians have been making for centuries, but they've created it through electronic sounds.
And sometimes all through the same set of writers, Max Martin and company.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Mole Hill, the band in studio tonight. They're playing at Subterranean tomorrow night in Wicker Park. They got a brand new EP that comes out May 12th called Hearts on Fire. Some of the tracks have already been released. You can find them online and all the sort of streaming sites. We'll take a quick break. We'll get an update from Rob Martyr. We'll come back. We'll hear some more music live in Studio 435 with the band Mole Hill. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase. Live music right here in our Allstate Showcase studio. Beautiful Michigan Avenue tonight. The cinematic pop sounds of the band Mole Hill. They've got the brand new EP out May 12th called Hearts on Fire. They've got a couple of those tracks already released. You can find them on streaming sites. Tomorrow they're going to be at Subterranean right at North Milwaukee and Damon and Wicker Park. Great little club. Love that place. They still have the black and white checkered floor. Yeah? All right, good. Good to know. I do the show every night. I didn't get a chance to get over there. They could have easily changed that floor, right? In studio tonight, Peter Manhart, Trevor Jones, Greg Van Zuden, and Devin Staples. They are Mole Hill. Here is the track live. Two Souls. Take it away, guys.
This one, they seem to pluck out all my other days. I don't know the right words, so I'll hold you in my arms till dawn breaks. And the moon shines alone tonight. Far away for all his life. Please don't cry, it only makes it harder when I'm leaving. I may be gone quite long, but I'm always gonna come back home to you. Our two souls have been connected since some other distant time. And when we die, I know that we will meet again in the next life. And maybe I'll stay home this time, so I can see you every night. Please don't cry, it only makes it harder when I'm leaving. I may be gone quite long, but I'm always gonna come back home to you. And when I'm far away on sleepless nights, I close my eyes and I can almost feel your breath upon my weary face. And when you're wakened by the breeze, I hope you wake up right next to me.
The band Molehill in studio. They got a new EP out this month called Hearts on Fire. Some of the tracks already released online. Check them out now. Tomorrow they're going to be at Subterranean, North Avenue in Wicker Park. In studio tonight, Peter Manhart, Trevor Jones, Greg Van Zuten, and Devin Staples. They're back at the table tonight. Yeah, you, look at that. That was a ballot. That's like... Yeah, you guys can do anything.
Pop it up. Pop it up.
Well, we were talking before the break just about, you know, the idea of being a band in this day and age when you can do so many different things with the music that's provided and the technology that's provided. I mean, if you could see on the webcam tonight, I mean, we're talking, you know, you guys have keys set up, synth set up, computers, the drum pad, which is an experiment for tonight. We appreciate that. One guitar, just standard, so standard. Peter, I feel for you. But I mean, there's so much you can do. Talk about that. Talk about the idea of are we going to see a renaissance of this kind of music with technology sort of being able to create beats and techniques and sounds that we haven't had before? Are we going to see a renaissance, or are we going to see sort of a dumbing down of the music where people are be able to press a button and do things that, you know, other musicians can do much more artistically.
Well, I mean, we're already in the present where people will pay lots of money to go to see somebody press a button in that sense. But it's also like, I mean, Pete, you've been to like, you saw what, Skrillex at
Bonnaroo.
At Bonnaroo. And, you know, it's like anytime you hear somebody complain about, it's like, oh, man, well, all he's doing is like pressing buttons. You go, yeah, I don't really think you're seeing the bigger picture. Like, I mean, dude, talk about like when you were there.
Yeah, you know, the this was in 08, I want to say. I went to Bonnaroo, and the first night I got there, it was kind of all mostly electronic acts. It was the, I want to say, Thursday night when I got there, and it just blew me away. Like, I'd never seen any live electronic acts, really, like any EDM acts or whatever. So just the sounds that they can get out of those speakers, it's like nothing you can,
nothing a real band can replicate.
Right. And where I was so far back in the crowd, you couldn't possibly see the stage or the person on the stage, and it didn't even matter. Nobody cared. It was just these amazing sounds were coming out of these speakers, and it just sounds really cool. And I mean, that's what it boils down to. People are there, and somebody will hit some super low bass synth sound, bass drop, and you'll hear people like scream from half a mile away because everybody's so excited about this bass sound that
now,
just happened.
I'll speak for probably a WGN audience who might be listening to this, might be someone who's older, who's a music lover, who says, well, I don't consider that to be music. That's sound. Maybe there's something in there that's projected, that's some sort of created computer generated sound, not the music that I know. Talk about, give us a nod for EDM music being music.
So, that's okay. That's okay if you look at it as just being sound. I think, though, before you trash something, I think it's worth understanding like why there's such a following for it. And at least the way you explain that whole experience to me, it is like this collective experience. And, you know, if the experience is, you know, just getting loaded and going to a show, well, I suppose that's one thing. But it's not like that's new. That's not new to this generation.
Right.
But, you know, I know for our band, we still definitely, you know, we like, you know, experimenting with sounds, you know, from a guitar as much as we like experimenting sounds from a vintage synth or something. But more than anything, I think in this band, we're just trying to write great songs, like that tells a great story, try to write the best melodies that we can. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, like, music hasn't changed at all. When you still listen to Bach or Beethoven, I mean, Beethoven was like the master of the rhythmic hook. It just kept coming back and back and back. Like Beethoven 5, that entire thing is built off, or the first movement is built off of this four-note motive. That's really impressive.
And when we talk about electronic music, I mean, I may, you know, say, well, this, you know, this movement that we know currently. Well, I mean, you can go back to rock bands and bands in the 70s and 80s specifically. I mean, you think of Depeche Mode or Joy Division.
The Who had, right? they were the first ones to run tracks at live shows.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a definite lineage in rock and roll of using these kind of sounds, even the sounds that you'll hear from a Skrillex or other DJs that are playing up on stage. So talk about that. I mean, there seems to be a long lineage. You find yourselves as a band sort of following in those footsteps?
I don't know. I mean, one of the hardest things I feel for at least us, and maybe this is just me, is like being really focused with writing. Like Arctic Monkeys, I always bring up this example, but their last album, AM, they did 12 songs. And I remember listening to like the first five or six songs, and I go, oh my God, they have done like the exact same arrangement for all five songs. I even think several of them are in the exact same keys. And it really bothered me at first. I was like, man, they just did the same thing over and over. And then I kept listening to the album. I go, oh, this is awesome. Like, they just figured out, I mean, they just chose to like follow this, whether it was arrangement, these sonic textures, see, Devin's nodding, these sonic textures, but they created a collection of songs that just feel so right together. And I know that's something like,
there's no electronics on that too, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. But that album was a massive hit. So like, you know, the idea of saying like, oh, well, guitar rock, guitar based rock and roll is dead. Well, yeah, it's definitely not what it once was. But to say that music somehow doesn't appeal to Sure. You know, to, you know, youth or, you know, older folks too. That's ridiculous. They just happen to write 12 amazing songs.
Is there, you know, you guys tour a lot. I mean, is there a like, where do you, when you think of it, like a fantasy bill, like the idea of like you'd be with the bands that you like and things, would you find yourself leaning more towards an EDM or an electronica type bill, or do you see yourself with rock and roll bands? Like, where do you guys see
yourself? Yeah. Sure. Yeah, we just saw at House of Blues on April 5th. We saw the great Scottish band Biffy Clyro, and Devin kept saying, he's like, Trev, man, I haven't seen you. He was like, you're like a little kid. And these guys came out on stage, and it is just like, it is fierce for two straight hours, and it was two of the greatest hours of my life. If there's any band we could tour with, it'd be Biffy Clyro.
Yeah, sure.
Simon Neil, if you're listening.
Yeah, above all, we consider ourselves a rock band. And yeah. I think we always want to stay true to music that rocks. Like, we want to have high-energy rock shows where people can go and get sweaty and rock out, and we will do the same on stage.
And our shows are loud.
Well, there you go. You can see it tomorrow night at Subterranean in Wicker Park. What time does that show start?
We're opening for the really cool bands Mona and Flagship, and doors are at 6, and we're on first at 6:45, and we do provide earplugs.
Yeah, we always bring free earplugs to shows.
Peter Manhart, Trevor Jones, Greg Van Zieden, and Devin Staples in studio. They are the band Molehill. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we'll get one last track here live in studio 4:35. Stay with us. All right, it's a download here on 720 WGN. Time for Studio 435. We wrap it up tonight. The cinematic pop sounds of the band Molehill. Their brand new EP is out on May 12th called Hearts on Fire. They've released a couple of those tracks, one we're going to hear right now. Tomorrow they're going to be at Subterranean. Doors open at 6. They'll be on stage around 6:45. Subterranean, of course, on North Avenue in Wicker Park. In studio, the band Molehill, Peter Manhart, Trevor Jones, Greg Van Zieden, and Devin Staples. The band, here is the track. We'll wrap up Studio 435 tonight with the track Reverie. Guys, take it away.
When the world still made sense and you had always been a part of it, maybe I was just a bit too innocent, but I never thought that you'd be leaving like this. I remember all the things you taught me. I was with you in the garden planting seeds, sharing space on the piano bench playing keys, how to be a man and what that really means. I still depend on you. I see you in my dreams. You showed us all about what a good life really means. There's nothing I wouldn't leave behind to have you in my life again. But you've already left a scent. You made me the person I am. If I could see you once again, I'd tell you everything you meant. All the people who loved you and you left them a story to tell. Ooh, but you made me the person I am. Heaven got a little brighter when you came. I'm sure the angels already knew your name. Did you think about me as your breath slipped away? 'Cause I think about you every day. I still depend on you. I see you in my dreams. You showed us all about what a good life really means. There's nothing I wouldn't leave behind to have you in my life again. But you've already left a scent. You made me the person I am. If I could see you once again, I'd tell you everything you meant. The people who loved you and left them a story to tell. Ooh, but you made me the person I am. I miss you all the time. it's nothing I wouldn't leave behind to have you in my life again. But you've already left a scent. You made me the person I am. If I could see you once again, I'd tell you everything you meant. All the people who loved you and left them a story to tell. Made me the person I am. Thank you, Chicago.
Yeah, there we go. Live in Studio 435. The band Molehill, that was the track Reverie, which is on the new EP, which is out May 12th. That song's actually been released. You can find it in streaming sites all over the world. I don't even know how to say it. You don't want to be so brand specific. You just want to say streaming sites available everywhere. The band Molehill will be on stage at Subterranean tomorrow night over in Wicker Park. Doors open at 6 o'clock. They're on stage at 6:45. Peter Manhart, Trevor Jones, Greg Van Zuden, and Devin Staples are the band members, and they are in studio tonight. Guys, I can't thank you enough. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
All right, that's going to do it tonight. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for the mix. As always, it's fun to have Molehill in studio. Tomorrow night we'll be back. Play the worst tomorrow night. It's going to be good. A couple of the ensemble members from the Cates are coming by. It's going to be a good time. Patty Vasquez up next. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio.